His forceful personality conflicted with Daly's equally strong character. Still, in the weeks leading up to the January 16th meeting, he'd been given his orders, delivered by none other than General Tommy Franks, Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Central Command, and therefore all forces in Afghanistan. Get some men out into the frontier to figure out what's going on. Simple enough. And that had led to the station meetings with Haas and the CIA. Yet what really mattered to Blaber was the coup de grace to any conventional military thinking that might get in the way of the final directive Franks provided him. Find the enemy, then kill or capture him. He needed no further guidance, and used his charter as a means to construct his much-preferred tactic, a joint team of the best operators in the world. To Pete, this meant Delta Force, SEAL Team 6, and, as events would later prove out, most critically for a campaign he had yet to wage or fully envision, combat control. 2 weeks later, Blaber and his growing composite force were living in a CIA safe house compound in the eastern Afghanistan town of Gardez, a Pashtun population center of 70,000 people and the capital of Paktia province. At 7,500 feet above sea level, surrounded by the southwest terminus of the Hindu Kush, Gardez enjoys an alpine atmosphere. Summers are hot and dry, and the little moisture it receives falls mainly in the winter and early spring in the form of snow. It is here that Afghanistan's legacy of conflict is made manifest. Now in ruins and resting above Gardez, foundations and crumbled walls can still be found marking Alexander the Great's easternmost outposts in his bid to conquer the known world. In the 4th century BC, against these same Hindu Kush mountains, Alexander was turned back, to be followed by so many others in the millennia to come. Like Alexander, AFO needed to position itself at the edge of the latest empire to sweep into Afghanistan. By the time of Blaber's arrival, the safe house had been running for some time, the cost underwritten by the CIA. As Blaber put it, they were the only ones with money in country at the time. The Army's Green Berets were already on site as well, training a 400-man Afghan tribal force referred to as the ATF. The ATF were the first installment of great hope for America's Afghanistan strategy, shouldering the burden of defeating the enemy in combat, under American direction and with American munitions, and establishing a Jeffersonian democracy in which girls could be educated and a viable, non-opium-based economy founded. The late arrival of Blaber's team relegated them to tent living in the compound's courtyard. That suited Blaber just fine. He preferred the Spartan arrangement. The safe house itself was more fortress than dwelling, sporting a dirt floor, colored 30-foot-high solid walls, and tile-roofed watchtowers that dominated its four corners. The masonry consisted of mud blocks that measured in feet, not inches, creating the appearance of the base of an Egyptian pyramid. The building was elaborate enough in its construction that each watchtower was adorned with what appeared to be ruddy, reddish-brown cedar tree designs instead of the usual undecorated mud-colored facing. With no place left but the center of the 200-by-200-foot courtyard, Blaber and his men erected several Army-standard GP, or general-purpose, medium tents capable of holding up to 20 men. The remainder of the open ground was consumed by vehicles and their maintenance, generators, and supplies. Massive 100-foot G-11 cargo parachutes that sometimes draped over the walls were evidence of the weekly Air Force C-130 resupply airdrops of ammo, water, and other supplies. Stacked and tumbled everywhere in the compound's dirt interior were wooden crates of olive drab green or unfinished pine, filled with ammunition, grenades, mines, rockets, and mortars. Linked 50-caliber and 7.62-millimeter machine gun ammo was strewn among the crates, evidence of men arming vehicles for heavy combat. Here and there were other signs American special ops were in town, the ubiquitous gym equipment, and sandbag stepping stones leading from tents to interior corridors and rooms for when dirt turned to mud. Inside the walls, the former residence took on its new identity as well. The CIA occupied the best digs, and Chris Haas's Green Berets took up the remaining space. The fused efforts of AFO, SF, and CIA could be seen in the Tactical Operations Center, referred to as the TOC. Its unfinished mud walls were adorned with maps, charts, and imagery. Radios and laptops were powered by compound generators that, like the men, ran 24/7. At the TOC's heart, ostensibly running the show, but in reality one leg of a triad, was the CIA's lead, a man named Greg, but whom everyone called Spider. Spider's nickname stemmed from his appearance, 6 foot, thin, and wiry. He and Blaber knew each other well. They'd worked together in Bosnia, hunting UN war criminals. Pete referred to him simply as the best combat leader in the CIA. Spider was a living, breathing example of how good the CIA could be when they had their best leaders on the ground. And the respect was reciprocated. Spider was well aware of Delta's capability to hunt men, but the fight shaping up in the Shahikot Valley would differ from anything Delta and AFO had encountered before. This time, killing the enemy wasn't going to happen by means of a bullet from a Delta sniper's gun, but through the handset of a radio. And that handset would be gripped by a combat controller. After setting up camp, Blaber's first order of business was to procure troops. The combined total of Americans and Gardez numbered about 50, but most were divided between the CIA, with their role of obtaining intel, and the SF, whose job it was to train and equip the ATF. The Green Berets centered on the efforts of ODA 510, the Special Forces Detachment responsible, were already training the Afghan militia, who were led by a warlord named Zia. The agency had been there the longest and had already established a reliable intelligence network. What Blaber needed now was a special operator with a specific skill set if he was to fulfill his mission with regard to the enemy. Corner and kill. Blaber knew there was only one place to go to get the men he needed. B Squadron. Having been their former commander didn't negate his need for approval to bring them from the States, so he went to TF-11 and Brigadier General Trebone, who gave the green light for 12 men from the squadron's reconnaissance element. It took one call to Fort Bragg, and Blaber was on the line with one of the best recce leaders in the business, Delta Master Sergeant Chris Kay. After he absorbed the information, Chris agreed to have his team ready to deploy to Afghanistan as quickly as possible. They loaded out with virtually everything their team had, SR-25s, M-4s, M203 grenade launchers, winter gear, and multiple uniforms. However, they were missing one critical component that, under normal circumstances, they would have had. They didn't have a combat controller with them, and it would take time for one to arrive in country. Already inside AFO were operators from Delta's Navy counterpart, SEAL Team 6. Two SEALs, Hans and Nelson, were in Gardez and already working for Blaber. Hans, who led the SEAL contingent, had made it clear the Navy was definitely not interested in conducting the operations in the Shahikot that Blaber had in mind, so much so that heated exchanges took place among various parties. Attached to the SEALs was a CCT by the name of Jay Hill. Hill was a 31-year-old career airman. At 6'3" and with a powerful physique, he had the requisite operator beard and long brown hair with sun-bleached bangs that swept across his face, like a surfer just out of the water from a morning set. He could easily be the poster image for combat control recruiting. Even his disposition struck many who knew him as laid-back surfer, as if combat were nothing to get riled about. He joined the Air Force in 1989 for the college education it afforded, and originally worked on aviation life support equipment at his first assignment at Pope AFB. While there, he began to run into controllers playing volleyball, working out, and generally enjoying themselves. What struck him most was how fit and confident they were. Eventually, he met a few, including an intense young CCT named Billy White, the very same controller from Tora Bora. The interactions left him thinking that perhaps he was missing something, and that, in his words, CCT looked like a great job. Jumping, diving, everyone's in good shape. I was 21 and it seemed a manly thing to do. I need to do what those guys are doing. In the summer of 1992, he cross-trained and, after successfully navigating the brutal training pipe, returned to Pope in 1993. This time assigned to the 21st STS. A few years later, he set his sights on the 2-4. Now, he stood among the best of all the services. His attachment to Team 6 was not a new experience, and like Blaber, he was on his second tour in Afghanistan. On October 19, 2001, he participated in the first combat jump of the war, Objective Rhino. Following that, he'd traversed southern Afghanistan with Delta's B Squadron, looking for bad guys to kill. After a rotation home for a brief Christmas celebration, he returned to Bagram and embedded with the SEALs of Red Team, the assaulters led by Hans, not the sniper element led by Slab. It was a series of decisions, assignments, and tricks of fate that led Jay, like Blaber, and everyone else at AFO, to Gardez. When he saw the downward direction of relations between the SEALs and Blaber, he made a decision. Even if the SEALs couldn't see the value in the opportunity being presented, and they didn't, he most certainly could. He approached Blaber, intent on changing teams. To an outsider, it might appear extreme to suddenly switch over, but controllers move so fluidly between forces like Delta, SEAL Team 6, and the SAS that he didn't give it a second thought. He also had a history with B Squadron and relished the chance to get outside the wire. As he recalls, at the time, the SEALs had a pretty bad attitude about AFO, and I realized I didn't want to miss out on a chance to do some real damage to Al-Qaeda. And, just like that, after their short exchange, he was back with the Army as soon as they could get there. Blaber couldn't have been happier. Though AFO was still a long way from hunting safari ready, another key piece, CCT, had fallen into place. Waiting to conduct recce missions didn't necessarily translate into idleness for the combat controller. Occasionally in the evenings, and especially during inclement weather, the safe house was subject to shelling by local militias not aligned with Zia and the Americans. Chris Haas, as the most senior special forces officer and the officer with the strongest relations with the Afghans, asked Jay, "Can you do something about that?" Jay replied, "Yeah, man, sounds good." The exchange and plan were very nonchalant, as he recalls, but in the end, he wound up with the authority to conduct strikes. Game on, he thought. For the combat controller, it was easy. I'd climb up on the roof at night with a couple of beacons, usually my Micropounder and an SST-181. There he'd work out where the tubes the Taliban set up were, using the beacons for his location, then provide the aircraft with a distance and direction along the lines of 800 meters at 086 degrees, talking them onto the location, starting with big descriptions for compounds or hilltops, and then necking it down. With the beacons, it worked well regardless of weather. The Delta guys weren't even aware he was conducting strikes at night, saying things like, "What are you talking about? What beacon? That box with the little Micropounder?" They'd say, "Dinner's at 8. Can you come down from the roof?" They had no clue. It was quite funny. They're very smart, but they're not. They just don't have the expertise in these other areas of combat. The hostile militias never expected it. There were no indications Americans were in the vicinity, because they weren't, and the weather was believed to provide security from American airstrikes, just as it had with the Soviets before them. The system worked well, eventually causing incoming fire to drop off completely. It shut them up. They never expected that, what with the crappy weather we had all the time. Chapter 10. The morning of February 10th was cold and clear. The frigid wind announced the proximity of the Hindu Kush as 24 men from a handful of units and government agencies pulled out of the safe house in a convoy heading southeast of the city. The lead vehicle slowed to a stop on a barren stretch of the valley floor. Chris Kay and his fellow Delta Recce teammates had departed the U.S. on February 9th. While they were winging their way toward Afghanistan, another reminder of their purpose took place at the Gardez safe house. Shortly after 9/11, Delta's B Squadron had conducted a social exchange and patch trade with members of the New York Fire Department in Manhattan. A few returned with pieces of the World Trade Center as mementos. Inevitably, some of these made their way to Afghanistan, their physical heft serving as raw energy to fuel the men in their pursuit of those responsible. A Delta operator named Kevin ferried one over with the intent of leaving this piece of America in the land that spawned the attacks. Bundling themselves against the cold, the informal group assembled around the senior CIA officer in Gardez as two men dug a small hole and placed the World Trade Center remnant in the shallow grave. The CIA officer spoke a few words, followed by the senior NCO from 5th Special Forces. Their memorial is buried at approximate latitude 33 degrees, 33 feet, 5.x inches north, and longitude 69 degrees, 15 feet, 8.x inches east. To Jay Hill, even though he was on his second tour, the ceremony brought back a sense of the surreal. Afghanistan was the last place on earth you'd expect to be. For Blaber, it was another example of their modus operandi. Spider, Chris Haas, and I, we had the time to set aside for this. It just sort of happened, another self-organizing activity. No one really set out a hierarchical structure. We just organized and executed. It was our distilled essence. While Jay's SEALs wanted out, at least one other SEAL wanted in on Blaber's operations. Homer was a former member of SEAL Team 6, currently on a joint assignment, who arrived shortly after the Trade Center ceremony. And, like a lot of guys, he was looking to get in on the action, according to Blaber. He became Blaber's sidekick in his travels around Gardez. Essentially, Homer's job was to make stuff happen. He could get anything by trade or trickery, and he was also a good sniper, recce advisor. His combat experience extended back at least a decade to Somalia, where he and a combat controller jointly saved the life of his sniper team partner during the operation that came to be known as Black Hawk Down. The arrival of Chris and his team completed the AFO force. At the safe house, they separated into two elements, I-Team and J-Team. I and J were used interchangeably in their phonetic India and Juliet. Chris would lead Jay, while another sniper, nicknamed Speedy, would lead the other team. Jay Hill wasted no time plugging into his new team, and Chris welcomed the controller's expertise. Planning began immediately, led by Jay Team. Their mission, as directed by Blaber, was threefold. Establish observation posts in enemy territory in the Shahikot Valley to confirm or deny the presence of senior Al-Qaeda leaders. Scout designated helicopter landing zones for a pending mission tentatively named Operation Anaconda. And finally, call in airstrikes on enemy positions when identified. With close collaboration between the CIA and Spider in place, this last objective was shaping up to have a significant impact on the American effort. U.S. intelligence estimated enemy numbers at approximately 200 in the Shahikot Valley in the mountainous region east of Gardez. Inside the Gardez TOC, between the CIA and AFO, it was believed the numbers were at least double that. As the teams began their in-depth analysis of the terrain and the enemy's historical tactics, they had no idea the actual force they were facing numbered between 1,000 and 1,500 in the valley, while an additional 700 staged in the valleys farther to the east toward Kaust. The first question facing the teams heading into enemy territory was how to get there. As Americans, their obvious first choice was the ubiquitous helicopter. Thanks to the CIA, AFO had access to Russian-made Mi-17s, a common sight throughout Afghanistan that didn't raise eyebrows the same way U.S. helicopters did. There was, however, a downside to employing any helo, even Russian birds. Weather and high altitudes were significant restrictors to their use. And if one was used to successfully insert a team, there was no guarantee, given the same challenges, you could rely on it to get them out, forcing you to gamble lives on the odds. Additionally, Blaber stood in strong opposition to helicopters for lift. This mindset stemmed from the necessity of AFO masking their presence inside the Shahikot Valley, but was rooted in a deeper understanding of the very nature of their use. The history surrounding mission failure in helicopter-borne operations stretched back to their inception in Vietnam, through Somalia, and up to dry-hole raids conducted early on in Afghanistan. After Somalia, a personal experience for Delta Force and CCT, Blaber's assessment was that every despot, drug kingpin, and dictator who had any reason to believe that the United States might be coming for him expected that when and if we actually came, we'd come in helicopters. Footnote. Barely a year later, the Iraqi army would circulate copies of the movie Black Hawk Down as a primer on how to defeat U.S. forces. With the U.S. default choice a non-starter, the team turned to vehicle drop-off, known as VDO, as a means to get close enough to their objectives for them to hike or climb the remainder of the way. As a test of the VDO concept, and to get a feel for the enemy situation, Chris, Jay, and two other Delta operators, Bill and Dave, set out for an abandoned town 10 kilometers east of Gardez. It was called Dara, and was a gateway to the team's early choice for an OP some 20 kilometers farther into the mountains. This was the first time Americans had traversed enemy terrain in the area. They used civilian Toyota Hilux pickups, a sort of low-grade version of a Tacoma, and they were accompanied by 15 ATF fighters who piled into the open back of the pickups for use as security. Just as important, the Afghans could be used to gather information from locals and the environment. In this, the ATF were indispensable. Clothed for the frigid February temperatures, their ATF escorts huddled in the back sporting brand new CIA-supplied sage green winter coats and AK-47s, the team set off for the mountains. They got as far as the ghost town before the deepening snow halted all progress, well short of the distance necessary for the team to haul their supplies and packs to their OP. Their mud-caked trucks could not get any farther through the snow and ice on the steep mountain slopes. The reality of what they'd be facing in the coming weeks dropped on the men like a mountain avalanche. In front of them towered a massive 12,000-foot-high peak that would have been an expedition by itself. Even the terrain in front of the numerous summits left them uncertain that we would even be able to get over some of the cliffs that were en route, according to one operator. Conferring in the snow, Jay and the Delta operators realized they wouldn't make it to their OP without getting resupplied, whether they encountered enemy forces or not. Furthermore, the trucks were now no more an option than helicopters. As the Delta operators continued to revise and shape their infiltration plan, Jay was experimenting with overhead air support. On the early missions, this usually took the form of a Navy P-3 Orion. Originally designed for anti-submarine warfare, the 1960s-era plane had four turboprop-driven engines and carried a suite of electronic tracking equipment designed expressly for finding subsurface signatures, and therefore lacking the sophistication of other airborne systems coming online in newer platforms. SOF troops had been using them as a poor man's ISR, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, the term referred to any overhead surveillance, for over a decade. Without sophisticated electronics and optics for ground terrain, they nevertheless provided a presence and coordination platform in the event of a crisis. Better still were the armed MQ-1 Predators beginning to roam the Afghan-Pakistan frontier. These had been purpose-built for the CIA and U.S. Air Force a few years earlier as a low-cost, remotely piloted surveillance platform, and were available in armed and unarmed versions, with the former eventually comprising the majority of the fielded fleet. In the early days of the war, the potential for fratricide was an ever-present danger to unconventional forces. Driving civilian trucks stuffed with Afghans in the back, and similar to Al-Qaeda's, the AFO shunned U.S. fatigues, and separating them from the enemy was an elusive task even on the best coordinated of missions. Pilots simply weren't used to identifying American forces not in uniform, especially when they were riding in non-military vehicles. The responsibility fell to Jay, as the lone CCT on the team, to manage and direct any aircraft. The eastern Afghan frontier remained the Wild West, even in the skies overhead. Controlling that air traffic with its multinational composition, diverse and often fragmented by competing missions, and the pilot's limited understanding of conditions on the contested turf, kept the combat controller on high alert whenever the team traveled. Jay's reality, with hundreds of sorties per day spanning the country, any one of them could find itself overhead on short notice, made it equally impossible for him to maintain a complete air picture. It was critical, though, that he take control of the airspace directly overhead in the event they came into contact with the enemy or were ambushed. On the next recce test foray, a drive between Gardez and Khoust, an armed Predator began tracking them as hostiles. Even though he succeeded in establishing contact, the team was nearly fired upon by their own country because they were traveling in a suspect convoy. It was becoming painfully clear that getting to their objective, as challenging as it was proving to be, was only a fraction of their problems. The two original AFO SEALs, Hans and Nelson, had participated in some of the recce trips, but tensions between them and the Delta operators came to a head on one mission when the Delta team leader pushed the four-man Army-Navy patrol mercilessly to determine their ability to move in steep, high-altitude terrain. Broadcasting his displeasure, Hans stated, "This is bullshit." After they returned to Gardez, more discussions took place directly addressing the disparity of approach to missions and attitudes, which Delta felt was unsatisfactory on the part of the Navy. In the end, Blaber let them know, "Hey guys, it's not working out." So he chopped them to Chris Haas's Green Berets, where they were happy to go on to something else. This cemented the decision and effectively cut the two SEALs from the AFO mission. Even as his two former SEAL teammates were exiting the scene, Homer understood the potential of the unfolding operations. One night, while he and Blaber were checking on the safe house guards and perimeter, he mentioned that recce SEALs from ST-6 were restless in Bagram. They felt imprisoned by the constraints of TF-11 targeting and planning. They're chomping at the bit to get out of their barracks and into the hunt. Blaber was in a quandary. He needed more troops, as he'd known even before they launched their first mission. But his relationship with the TF-11 commander was becoming more strained as he continued to form a force and operations extracurricular to TF-11's core mission of targeting high-value individuals. These were personified most publicly in the form of bin Laden and al-Zawahiri, the number two al-Qaeda leader. But Blaber believed that was not AFO's only purpose. He recognized the disproportionate and decisive impact a handful of the world's best operators, well-positioned and hidden among the enemy, would have on the coming battle. Some in the TF-11 Operations Center had taken to referring to Blaber as Peter the Great or Colonel Kurtz, in reference to the movie Apocalypse Now, for his obvious gone native immersion. But Blaber saw skepticism and sarcasm as net positives, because it was far better to be doubted than micromanaged. It was clear any request for additional Delta Force troops would be unsuccessful. Yet there was another option, especially for a non-parochial opportunist such as he. Just because the previous SEALs and AFO weren't interested, it didn't necessarily translate to the rest of SEAL Team 6. There were SEALs already in country, largely locked up inside their Bagram base due to TF-11's mentality. That group included a frustrated slab and his CCT, John Chapman. Blaber recalls, "The SEALs weren't interested in doing AFO at the time. They thought it was a waste of manpower. At one point, I had a 60-minute VTC with TF-11 Commander General Daly, and he was not interested in what we were doing. Not interested in giving more manpower, but I persisted. Basically, with a minute to go on the VTC, he said, 'Fine, I'll give you some SEALs,' and then signed off. Those SEALs were from Team 6, and therefore belonged to the unit's commander, Captain Joe Kernan. Kernan tasked the only SEAL snipers under his command based in Bagram, which meant Slab's men from Red Team, along with John Chapman and Andy Martin. But tasking didn't clarify who would be moving 100 miles south to Gardez and who would stay in the hope of killing HVTs, high-value targets, with TF-11. Kernan only agreed to send half a dozen men with one controller. Slab was of the opinion that TF-11's Bagram mission construct was more likely to produce confirmed kills. He had a dozen men, including the two CCT, broken into two elements. Slab himself led the first element, designated Mako 3-0. The second element, designated Mako 3-1, was led by the operator called Goody. As controllers, Chapman and Martin took their call signs from their respective assigned elements, but used an additional designation. CCT on the battlefield and in published communication matrices were almost always identified by a C suffix, pronounced phonetically in transmissions as Charlie. This distinct designation allowed leaders, gunships, helicopters, and other CCT to readily identify them as controllers. In practice, the designation expedited close airstrikes because fighters, bombers, and gunships knew any Charlie call sign would belong to an experienced and expert strike director. When the two controllers on Slab's team separated, Chapman's call sign, working for Slab, was always Mako 3-0 Charlie, and Martin, working for Goody, was Mako 3-1 Charlie. The decision on who to send was Slab's to make as team leader, and he elected to send Goody's four SEALs and Andy Martin, choosing to hold the HVT mission for himself. With orders given to relocate, Andy and his SEALs began to pack and prepare for extended mountain operations, some of them grumbling about relegation to the B-team mission. Having seen the value and action in his previous non-HVT missions, Andy took the opposite position. I was motivated. Goody, taking the decision in stride and in keeping with his reputation as easygoing, went about prepping his men without complaint, but asked the controller, "You ready for this?" Not prone to statements of ambiguity, Martin replied, "Fuck yeah." Chapter 11, February 23rd. Back in Gardez, J. Hill and J. Team continued to experiment with insertion methods. This sometimes took on humorous facets as the men considered all options. In the vicinity of Gardez, there were large numbers of jackasses, so the men brought a few inside the compound and tried variations of pack configurations. The animals proved to be so unruly and difficult to manage that the option was quickly abandoned, and they returned to vehicles as the most viable insertion means. Their next test reconnaissance took the men closer to a large humpback mountain named Turgal Gar, but universally referred to by the American forces as the Whale for its rounded humpback shape. They traveled the main road south out of Gardez, this time with a larger ATF contingent wedged in the back of their trucks due to the increased Al-Qaeda numbers believed to be in the area. Their destination was another valley called Peanut to the east of the Whale, near a mountain called Taker Gar. As they neared the entrance to Peanut Valley, their interpreter, an Afghan they called Engineer because he'd been trained as one before the latest war to tear his country apart, announced that there were two AQ bases up the valley, and the AQ were watching them at that time. To the Americans, the ATF's ability to determine Al-Qaeda at a distance and by location was sometimes uncanny. When Chris asked Engineer how he could distinguish local Afghans from foreigners like Al-Qaeda, he said, "It's easy, and I can tell from 1 kilometer away by the way they act, look, and walk." This ability was proved time and again, and once saved a 5th Group Special Forces patrol when Engineer correctly identified, specifically, Chechens and Uzbeks at a distance and prevented the ODA from being ambushed. On the journey, Jay had a Predator overhead and ensured the surrounding terrain was under surveillance. As they considered Peanut, the Predator picked up 7 vehicles and 20 packs, personnel, moving 3 kilometers east of Taker Gar Mountain. The team discussed their options, still hoping to penetrate the valley for a better view of the mountains closer to their intended OPs. They conferred with Engineer, asking what they'd need to go any farther. The answer? 100 men and aircraft dropping bombs in front of them. They turned for Gardez without incident, but their eyes followed the mountains receding in the distance, with the challenges and unknown enemy numbers still masked by the snowy summits. Jay's team made one more excursion to test their methods and abilities only 48 hours before Operation Anaconda was to begin. This time, again in the mountains east of Gardez, they were dropped off and hiked in on foot, assessing the steep terrain for its ability to support the use of all-terrain vehicles, ATVs. We went in, looked, listened, absorbed atmospherics, and froze our butts off up in the mountains. It was snowing, raining, freezing cold. They equipped themselves with the best gear available, large mountaineering packs, spray-painted by the men in individual patterns of khaki and tan to better distribute loads, desert camo Gore-Tex to blend in, and also to protect from the elements, and even more critically, they brought Afghan scarves and blankets to mask their American appearance from a distance. They left body armor behind because it was physically impossible to add the extra weight, upward of 20 pounds in early 2002. They brought one sleeping bag among the entire team, solely as a life-saving measure should someone go hypothermic. Otherwise, they had Norwegians, a thin and lightweight insulation layer they combined with a Gore-Tex shell for the few hours they could attempt to sleep. These two items, when separated, served a more important purpose than semi-warmth for sleep. They could be molded to pad and sound-dampen equipment like radios and batteries, the bulk of their load. Several key realizations came from the trip. The first was that tents were an absolute necessity at 10,000 feet in the snow and low temperatures if they were to stay out for any duration. Also paramount was the diminished life expectancy of batteries, which they quickly discovered was half the normal battery life in the sub-freezing temperatures. This information was critical to Jay if he was to keep them adequately in communication with HQ and aircraft. The most important of these batteries were the BA-5590s that powered the PRIC 117, their primary SATCOM and CAS radio. Each battery added 2.25 pounds of dead weight to the operator, but also a critical handful of hours of operating time, which could save countless lives in combat. With 120-plus pounds of gear each, They learned the team could move only 2 to 3 kilometers a night. To understand the sheer physical and psychological stress on Jay and the other AFO forces, imagine standing at the base of a towering 10,000-foot mountain on a frigid winter night, the temperature already below freezing, and beginning its nightly plummet to near 0 degrees Fahrenheit. Heave 2 50-pound sacks of concrete onto your back while your chest and arms are loaded down with weapons, batteries, radios, GPS, knife, and an emergency medical pouch. Step forward with your right foot and immediately post-hole into the snow, each step a strain on your back and body, your lungs searing as they gasp for oxygen in the thin atmosphere. And you know there will be no sleep tonight, or possibly even tomorrow. Top it all off with an uncomfortable head harness or helmet for your NVGs, which will be squeezing your cranium for the 14 hours of darkness that lie ahead, during which you will attempt to scale 2 miles of snowy, rocky mountain. Furthermore, there are only 4 of you, and should you encounter an enemy force of any significance, your limited numbers and ammunition and all your superior expertise will not hold out for long. For Jay Hill, besides the immense physical load and discomfort, there's the added burden of being the lone warrior who can change the outcome of the battle using his expertise to bring American air power to bear, saving everyone, or, if he fails, carrying that failure for life. So as a rule, he carried as many batteries as he physically could. As the AFO men recovered to the safe house, affectionately proclaimed to be Hotel Gardiez by a sign posted adjacent to the main entrance to the TOC, Andy Martin and Mako 3-1 were loading out vehicles for the day-long drive. They arrived late in the afternoon under a fading steel-gray sky in mid-February, the first time the entire Delta, SEAL, and CCT force of AFO joined under Blaber. The men, most of them familiar with each other, shook hands and hugged in greeting, and took stock of one another and what lay ahead. For Jay and Andy, it was a joyous reunion. The two friends had worked together for years and shared a passion for practical jokes, usually at each other's expense. With all his forces assembled, Blaber prepared for what was to come. Operation Anaconda was shaping up to be the largest operation of the war, a classic hammer and anvil. Staging from the safe house, the hammer would consist of 400 of General Zia's ATF and additional Afghan units, augmented by Chris Haas's Green Berets, along with CCT Bill Sprake. This force would push south from Gardez around the Whale and focus on the center of the Shahikot Valley, driving the enemy toward the anvil. The preponderance of U.S. forces for Anaconda were commanded by Major General Franklin Hagenbeck, a combination of 10th Mountain and 101st Airborne Divisions. They would form the anvil against the mountains leading east toward Pakistan, their enemy's predicted escape route if they fled the might of hellebore troops and massed Afghan forces. Or so the U.S. Army believed. Blaber intended to put the 3 AFO teams now under his command, J, I, and Mako 3-1, in the field and positioned at well-chosen and concealed OPs to report enemy locations and movements. Once situated, his combat controllers could call in airstrikes to kill as many enemy as possible. For Martin and the SEALs of Mako 3-1, it was instant mission immersion. Delta and Jay had conducted all the reconnaissance and analysis and enjoyed the advantage of a couple weeks' acclimatization. Mako 3-1 would have none of this. And Blaber had a surprise in store for them. Of the 3 OPs going out, Mako 3-1's location was considered the most critical. Centered between the 2 Delta teams and proximal to Taker Gar, it commanded the best view of the air corridor that the conventional forces would be using. With little advance notification and few details, Blaber's surprise came as a shock. According to Martin, they learned they could expect to be walking between 9 and 12,000 feet and don't expect medical exfil or any kind of fire support prior to H hour if you guys get fired up. We'll try to help you as best we can, but we're not going to burn this mission. They would have the longest distance to infill in the least familiar terrain, because the AFO recce's were simply unable to get close to their OP. Goody absorbed all this calmly. As he and his team were conducting their mission preparations, Blaber asked his newest team leader, "So, what do you think?"
"Sir, this is one hell of a mission. I really appreciate you bringing us out here to be part of it," said the SEAL, paying more attention to his gear than to the Delta officer.
Blaber nudged his shoulder to ensure he had the SEAL's attention. "Goody, the success or failure of your mission will predicate the success or failure of the entire operation. You have to make it to that OP before H hour."
"Sir, I'll make it to my OP come hell or high water. If we're hurting on time, we'll drop our rucks. If we're still having problems, we'll keep dropping gear until five naked guys with guns are standing on the OP at H hour."
Blaber remembers thinking clearly, "Where do we get such men?" It was just what the AFO commander was looking for, and what he expected from the best. In Bagram, two other combat controllers, John Wiley, call sign Jaguar 1-1, and Jim Hoteling, call sign Jaguar 1-2, had also received short-notice taskings from their own commander. In this case, it was to join the famed Australian Special Air Service Regiment, known by the acronym SAS, or alternatively, SASR, to serve below the Whale and take her gar as safeguards against escape routes through the southern end of the valley. Two six-man teams, including their CCT, would be inserted by separate MI-17s and establish independent OPs where they would report enemy movement and call airstrikes. Established under its own separate task force, designated TF-64, it was the Aussie's first opportunity to put its most elite force into action in any significant operation in the new war. For them, it was a chance to build on the legacy they'd started with America in Vietnam. TF-64 worked directly for the 10th Mountain Division and Major General Hagenbeck, and therefore had no direct connection to the AFO forces, with one exception, combat control. Back at Gardez, with everything set for AFO to infill, the men of I-Team, J-Team, and Mako 3-1 spent their last night indoors, to a man thinking about the ground operations to come. There was one exception. Jay Hill was considering the three-dimensional battlefield picture, but it was incomplete. You have to remember, Operation Anaconda was planned in a vacuum from an AFO standpoint. And air planning was an afterthought, as the whole thing was planned by the conventional army. "I should have flown to Bagram for more information, but we didn't know there wasn't a deliberate air plan." The combat controllers of AFO were about to learn just how little the army had considered their role, or the need for air power.
Chapter 12. February 28th. Dusk. Jay Hill assessed his ATV, a Honda four-wheeler specifically outfitted by Delta's mechanics with a beefier suspension, a winch for recoveries, infrared headlights, and most importantly, a quiet run exhaust to muffle the throaty sounds of the vehicle. There were only four ATVs for the five men on Juliet team, three Delta operators, Chris, Bill, and Dave, and a signals intelligence operator named Jason, whose job it was to intercept enemy transmissions to identify targets for the team to destroy, and also to relay the raw intelligence to the TOC. Jay was the fifth member, and even though he had more equipment and weight than anyone else, there was no way a Delta operator was going to have a signals guy riding bitch, so it fell to Jay to haul Jason to their OP. Looking at the rig, Jay decided it wasn't a pretty picture. He had his rucksack, jammed with a Prick 117,
the backbone of every controller's close air support. The radio was the size of two heavy dictionaries lying spine to spine and weighed 10 pounds without batteries. 10 BA-5590 batteries, two handheld M-Biter radios, another multi-spectrum radio but smaller and less capable than a Prick 117, as backups for the Prick 117 with batteries, a Panasonic Toughbook laptop with batteries and cables, a portable DMC-120 satellite antenna, an SMP-2000 micropondar beacon, used for beacon bombing in inclement weather, infrared IR strobes for positive identification at night by other forces and aircraft, a laser rangefinder, two types of ISLID laser pointers for marking targets with infrared, and various additional marking devices. To this, he added two Nalgene quart plastic bottles for melting snow against his body when he slept. He had no stove. And a handful of MREs. With so much necessary gear, he ran out of room and was forced to leave most of his comfort items, such as additional clothing layers, behind. He had no sleeping bag, merely a bivy shell, using his puffy Combs jacket for insulation. In the end, his gear was heavier and bulkier than anyone else's on the team, and his creature comforts were fewer. Jay's other critical items were carried on his body. 3 GPS units, a small Garmin, a large and heavy PLGR military type, and a small wrist mount. His M4 and 5 magazines containing 30 rounds each, a conventional compass, an NVG compass, and a VS-17 panel for daylight marking. All of these items were carried in his Rhodesian vest in addition to a first aid kit and knife. He used a helmet. They all did. But they weren't ballistically significant. Quite the opposite. The men used cut-down versions of the plastic Protex skate helmet, modified by hand to remove the over-ear portions. The operators then added pile Velcro to the shell to attach items such as IR strobe lights and glint tape for AC-130 identification, and most important, snaps for affixing NVGs. Mounted on the front cargo rack of the ATV was an X-wing antenna, basically a foot-high, 3-inch diameter mast with a 4-blade radiator fan from an import economy car glued across the top, that allowed him to switch between satellite and line-of-sight, or LOS, communications without changing antennas. This was critical if they made enemy contact while driving. There'd be no time to switch out equipment if he was both calling in airstrikes and driving the ATV. It was a massive load for the commercial ATV, and he hadn't even added his passenger on the back yet. But as an Air Force guy, Jay was reluctant to pawn off weight on teammates lest they view him as weak. Every controller was constantly on guard against this perception. In actuality, one of the second-order effects of this dynamic was a pressure to perform at the top of every competition and during every operation. It manifested itself in the respect most CCT earned in training and combat. The other effect, as in this case, was an inordinate burden. Not only the weight of lone responsibility, but gross weight itself. On the morning of February 28, 2002, the reality for Jay was clear. Some batteries would have to be distributed among the others. Like the pounds he carried, Jay's duties as a controller were largely invisible to Delta. To them, the controller's actions were merely FM, fucking magic. Things just happened, if they even realized they took place at all. As he configured the maxed-out ATV, Jay was faced with his first challenge before even engaging the ignition. Falcon View, a mapping software for laptops developed by Georgia Tech Research Institute TechGeeks using C++ language for the Air National Guard in 1993. It allowed users to track identified targets, friend and foe, and themselves on a moving map. It also allowed users to switch between several types of maps, such as aeronautical charts, U.S. Geological Survey topographic maps, and even satellite imagery. Falcon View was still nascent in its development, and only the Air Force, which meant only CCT, had it on the battlefield. Jay's challenge was how to configure his toughbook so he could access the software while the team was en route. With Jason jammed behind him, he'd be pushed up against the gas tank between his legs, and that was the only place the laptop could be situated for ease of access. After trying various configurations, he settled on a combination of black Velcro strips glued to the tank and laptop and held in place against vibrations and potential rollovers by bungee cords as they ascended the treacherous slopes of the mountains framing the Shahikat Valley. Unfortunately, Falcon View was not compatible with NVGs. In order to view maps, Jay would have to stop his vehicle, kick Jason off the back, and open and fire up the toughbook while Delta pulled security for him. He'd then have to yank his poncho sleeping bag from a cargo pocket and drape it over his head to guard against the bright screen compromising their position. To connect the laptop remotely, he had a small helmet-mounted hockey puck-shaped antenna connected via Bluetooth. Nearly two decades later, it may seem commonplace or even simple, but shortly after the turn of the century, the configuration was cutting edge, particularly on the outer fringe of possibility under combat conditions. In all, there was no more room on man or machine for additional weight or gear. Looking over the line of ATVs, Jay shook his head. Gear hung everywhere, piled dangerously high on the vehicles, making them top-heavy and all the more dangerous on the mountain slopes. "We look like gypsies." It was pretty comical. As the day advanced, heavy skies loomed and rain began to turn to snow. Predictably, the temperature dropped accordingly. Chris, the Delta team leader of J-Team, checked with the TOC while the others made their final preparations. Just before leaving, a source reported to the CIA that the majority of the enemy was in the mountains and to the east of Shahikat, he recalled later. More good news. Their route also took them past a dangerously hostile village called Menjawar, which was still an AQ holdout that they most assuredly would need to give a wide berth due to the latest news. Capping it off was the announcement by the 5th Group Green Berets training Zia's militia, who were known to have Al-Qaeda sympathizers within their 400-men ranks, that they hadn't told the Afghan commander about the mission until 12 hours earlier, fearing a leak. Nevertheless, Chris learned, shortly after notifying Zia, the AQ knew Shahikat was going to be attacked. The news was met with shrugs. The teams were already going deep into enemy territory. Another confirmation of the enemy's awareness wouldn't change the tactics or dynamics of the operators. The info plan was conceived to get all three teams, J, I, and Mako 3-1, inserted in one movement. To do this, they were all prepped and staged together. J team had the only ATV riders, and the other two teams would conduct their own vehicle drop-offs after J team peeled off. Two Hilux pickups led the convoy, each with a Mag 58 7.62mm machine gun and a SAW, a lighter-weight 5.56mm weapon with a higher cyclic rate. These were manned by the infill insertion team, led by John B., a Delta captain well-respected among the senior NCOs of the unit. Three more Delta operators and the now-excluded SEAL, Hans, rounded out the infill insertion team. 15 ATF fighters jammed under the back of the trucks for security and additional firepower. The ATVs of J-Team brought up the rear. In the event of contact, the trucks had the heaviest firepower. Andy Martin had his gear prepped and staged with his SEAL teammates. A very type A personality, he was ready to get on the mountain and kill Al-Qaeda, certain that when the time came, the killing would be almost exclusively his domain. This would not turn out to be the case, but he had no way of knowing that Mako 3-1's mission would be the most difficult, dangerous, and decisive of the three. At the rear of the convoy, Jay observed his Delta teammates and felt confident in his abilities and their plan, and remembers thinking,
These are the guys you want to do this with. This is why I'm in the 2-4, and why we did all those winter warfare training trips and ATV training.
But he knew this was no easy infill, and the mission outcome was anything but certain, nor was it fully within their control. Still, Jay, who'd spent years preparing, thought,
"This is what I was meant to do. We're going to put eyes on the valley and wreak havoc."
Recalling the moment, he states, "Everything came together as a controller. It was literally a CCT mission. Go time." They rolled out of the compound gate in the dark just after 1900 hours and traveled south along Zermatt Road, where the mountain's presence in the distance was more felt than seen. At the drop-off point, J-Team bade their farewells, wishing the other team's luck, and turned east. On their own, they broke into pairs, Bill in the lead with Dave behind, Chris and Jay with his human cargo Jason bringing up the rear. Everyone was connected by inter-team radio via headsets under their helmets. For the combat controller, it was the start of days of nonstop communication and responsibility. The Delta operators were solely on their designated inter-team radio net, whereas Jay had three separate nets coming through his Peltor headset. Peltors were green, dual-ear hearing aids and communication sets that doubled as ear protection from gunfire or eardrum-damaging explosions. They cut off all sound above a certain decibel and simultaneously enhanced ambient noise, allowing the men to enjoy a sort of bionic man hearing. Jay was on inter-team like everyone else, in addition to being plugged into their designated SATCOM frequency, or FREAK, to remain connected with Pete Blaber. He also dialed in to an air-to-ground FREAK that he used to establish communication with the J-STARS aircraft overhead. Joint Surveillance and Target Attack Radar System was the full name for the Air Force's Boeing 707 conversion used for ground surveillance, battle management, and command and control. It had powerful radar systems, allowing it to track hundreds